In financial accounting, right? Restatement is a word that people try to avoid.
It's a dirty word.
It's a dirty word, exactly. You know? But in sustainability reporting, actually, sometimes to think about it, it's actually good to do restatement.
Welcome to the pre-read. Just like the slides you get before a big meeting, the pre-read prepares you, CFOs, and other executives for the next big thing. It's the global podcast where finance, sustainability, audit, and risk teams come together in the C-suite.
If you're making decisions at scale or need to understand the leaders who are, you're in the right place. This is the pre-read brought to you by Workiva.
I'm Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado.
And I'm Melissa Zucker, sustainability nerd and equal opportunist caffeine addict.
Today, we have two guests who represent two sides of the same problem. Later in the episode, we'll hear from Jonathan Gregory, the global controller at the Hershey Company. But first, Alyssa, you recently were in Singapore and sat down with Dr. Lee Hui Min, who has spent 25 years leading sustainability across conservation, retail, and now Singtel, one of Asia's largest telco groups. So, Alyssa, what did you talk about?
Dr. Lee lays out the conceptual foundation, what sustainability data actually is and what it isn't, and why the finance playbook doesn't map directly to it. A couple of key takeaways from our talk. The first, precision is actually the wrong standard for sustainability data, because a 42.6 versus a 43-ton emission figure doesn't change the material reality. Sustainability audits are about spotting hotspots and preventing greenwashing, not about achieving decimal point level accuracy. Finance leaders absorbing ESG functions need to recalibrate what good data means. The second, and to Steve's earlier point, restatement in sustainability is a feature, not a failure. When financial teams see a restatement, they assume that something went wrong. When sustainability teams restate it, it often means that they've improved their methodology or accessed higher quality data. That's progress, not a mistake, and the market should read it that way. And third, Scope 3 visibility breaks down fast as you go deep into the supply chain. By Tier 2, many suppliers are SMEs with no infrastructure to provide emissions data. Dr. Lee's guidance, proxy where you must, engage where you can, and keep investing to get closer to real data over time.
Well, Alyssa, if only a restatement meant progress. But in the meantime, let's get to hear your interview with Dr. Lee.
Dr. Lee, you've led sustainability across conservation, retail, and now one of Asia's largest telco groups. Each one of those environments has a completely different relationship with data rigor. And so what does that journey tell you about why the sustainability data quality problem is so challenging to solve?
I think to begin with, right, when we talk about sustainability data, we are really looking at a lot of data that's coming from operations, right? As you can see that in my past jobs, a lot of the real economy data, it really comes through the day-to-day operations of the company. And depending on what sector you're in, depending on where you're at, the data's not necessarily does come in the form and shape that you like. Right. Hence, I think that the data quality challenge comes from the fact that how do you identify what data they collect? How do you identify the way of collecting or collecting that data so that you can make sure that data is captured, digitized and ready for storage in a structured manner that helps you ladder up to the greater sustaining matrix that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that really it's that single thread that I do see very common in all the different jobs that I have been to.
Mm-hmm.
The other challenge also has to do with legacy systems and legacy practices. Let's not forget that the digitalization journey, especially in Singapore, it happens pretty rapidly in the last 3 decades. So if you have anything that is built before the last 3 decades, likely you're not going to find anything that's in digital form. And if they're in physical form, yes, we can digitize it, but you might not even find anything in physical form as well. I do expect that as we continue to develop and things increasingly get more digitized from the onset, that problem will sort of get alleviated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It makes me think of the conversation we were having before about the distinction between sustainability data and financial data.
Yes.
Because sustainability data, you know, you can use an example of the technician filling the refrigerant in your HVAC system. Or if there's a record, it could be in such a disparate place, like nowhere integrated into the corporate workflow of data management. And so kind of integrating sustainability into those core workflows as you digitize is a real, it sounds like a real transformation of especially this, where the Singapore market might be today.
Yeah. And actually, if you think about it, a lot of data, the refrigerant data, for example, right, they get top up. And sometimes they get consolidated and only comes to you in an invoice from a supplier, right? If you use the same supplier. And how do you make sense of that when you don't actually know where it's been
put? Mm-hmm.
We can take that data, but if you really want to sort of pinpoint and look deeper in the analysis to look at actually which areas using more, do we need to think about improvement to reduce our emissions?
So finance teams have had decades of process around data integrity. Right. So they've got period closes and controls and audit trails that's so foundational to the discipline of what they're doing. And sustainability teams are being asked to kind of follow a similar standard now. So from your experience, what's the hardest thing about transitioning the sustainability function into that kind of mindset and process?
I think, again, fundamentally, the two differences. Financial audit happens for a reason, and the requirement of financial audit versus the reason why we do a sustainability audit, they are a little bit different. Financial audit, you really talk about the integrity of the data. It has to be precise, and people want it to know how it lands, and there is a certain process that you follow, which is very well established in the last 20, 30 years, right? Now, on the other hand, in sustainability audit, while we do sustainability audit for integrity, but the preciseness of integrity is not to the point. 42.6 ton of emission versus 44, or for that matter, 43, right? It doesn't really matter because they're in the same ballpark. And anyway, all emissions are in estimate, right? When we do sustainability audit, really is to find out what's the material issue, where are the hotspots, as well as to make sure that there is no greenwashing. There is proof points, right, that when we report this number, there's a reason, there's a logic to that. And it comes down to really reflects the real happening that the emission is incurred. So in this two form, if you're expecting sustainability data to be so precise, 41.2 to 41.3, you want to solve that 0.2, it's almost impossible, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And whereas you get 10 to 1 to balance it, right? So I think the challenge is really how to get each other, the finance team and the sustainability team, think about the other issues, and then somehow slowly we come to a landing on this is how sustainability data auditing should look like, right? Back to my point about payment. Whether or not a customer pay me doesn't change the fact that I'm going to, if my methodology says that this is where I'll apportion my emissions to the customer, whether my customer pay me or not doesn't really change the way I decide that it has to be there, right? Of course, not forgetting that we should all strive, you know, to improve the data rigor, make sure the accuracy is there. But I don't think we will ever get to a point where they're really totally the same because they're off differently. The other point I want to talk about this is I think in financial accounting, right, restatement is a word that people try to avoid.
It's a dirty word,
exactly, you know. But in sustainability reporting, actually, sometimes to think about it, it's actually good to do restatement because it's very nascent, it's very new, and we find better ways as we all continue. Take category one, for example. As we continue to move from spend-based to supplier-specific to activity-based, right, you are really looking at improving the accounting process to delink it from spending and to the real activity, that which is more representative of what's really happening, right? And hence the ability to manage the emission. If you have the ability to have activity data this year, you won't use spend base. But it's because we don't have and then you need time to build. And by the time you have it, it's actually not a bad thing to actually reinstate to more representative, right? And it helps. It helps the entire market to learn, industry to learn. So restatement in sustainability happen very often. And that's probably something that the people in the financial sector can't really appreciate enough. So that in itself is also something that we need to reconcile.
I've spoken to so many peers about this because exactly to your point, when it comes to financial reporting and accounting, you will do anything to avoid a restatement because it kind of demonstrates you messed up, you made a mistake, right? But sustainability is in such a different place where the accounting system is literally, the accounting system is evolving, the methodology that you use within that accounting system changes over time as you get access to better data. And restatement, I think, actually is a signal to market that you're investing in this exercise to make it more decision useful, to make it more relevant to your business.
Yes. And it's also the effort, you know, sometimes people tend to, we've ever gotten comments about, oh, you're just improving your scope 3 by doing accounting tricks. But I explain to people to say that, look, the process of us investing resources and effort to look at improving the emissions factor, look at getting better quality emissions factor, in itself is an investment by the company too. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Mm. Well, so you've mentioned scope 3, and I know your background is in circular, what we call today circular economy. So as kind of circular economy, and also as a supply chain, you know, this work has always been so central to your to your background. Yes. And now that we have the scope 3 and climate related disclosures under regulatory scrutiny, how are organizations to report on what's actually happening in their supply chains to this point on almost waiting for your suppliers to be able to provide that product carbon footprint? And what's still getting in the way of them being able to do that?
I think the bigger issue is sometimes it's not for the lack of willingness. Again, coming back to a lot of, if you think about it, the supply chain is not usually one tier. A supply chain is usually multi-tier, right? When we buy something from, for example, Singtel make our own routers, right? We have Singtel branded routers. In a router, you imagine my manufacturer does the manufacturing of the router. But he in turn would have just a supplier, right? Mm-hmm. Their sub-supplier who then sells them the plastic, sells them the component,
right, the component parts
and et cetera. So I think the challenge has always been the traceability and the visibility down the chain. And you sometimes realize that when you get down to tier two, I wouldn't even go to tier three, right? If you get down to just tier two, the company can already be quite a SME, right? Mm-hmm. And the SME who might not have the necessary environment or setup to provide that data or even understanding what we're trying to get for. So the product carbon footprint part of things, I think it has to be that. And then the next thing is if we can't, then we just really have to do our best of ability, proxy it, and then hopefully over time you get real data.
Yep. Yeah, it's almost like don't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Totally,
engage where you can, get the data where you can. And that's the value of, that's why they call it proxy information. It's a proxy. It's meant to be representative.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Leading net zero work across a multi-country, very large telco group is an enormous data challenge. And we spoke about this before with the digitization of data. But when you think of collection and normalization and verification across all the different business units and all the different markets. So from your perspective, where is technology really helping your team to manage that? And then where, frankly, are you still doing this the hard way or the old school way?
I say with a bit of mix, we do have a system, but the system is pretty dated. We try to use as much as we can, and probably some of the functions are not as good for now. But nonetheless, we still continue. I think I have to say that largely still manual, but we improve along the way in the sense that Excel has a lot of function. We have really graduated from a simple Excel sheet to advanced Excel sheets, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's this narrative around sustainability reporting shifting from a compliance burden to a strategic asset, right? From this back office obligation to a board level and market signal. Do you believe that shift is actually happening inside of most organizations, or does that sound more aspirational compared to what you're seeing in practice?
I think, I actually think It depends on how you see it, right? I've been in sustainability for 25 years, right? Way back, you get a few companies who are really progressive, the likes of Patagonia, IKEA, who are really progressive. You look into it, and then you start doing something about it from the fact that I can differentiate myself and there is a premium that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually do development and you actually do... And that honestly was what I was doing 20 years ago. So I came from seeing sustainability and trying to sell sustainability as a competitive edge.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a compliance function that I started in, right? At that point in time, it was really totally voluntary, depending on companies. If the company progressive thinks about it, then they get doing it. Mm-hmm. So you see that, in a way, there's a bit of a self-selection. Right? People who want to get into sustainability at that point in time are people who really think about it, believe in it, wants to do something. So you see that as from a value creation, a strategic,
mm-hmm.
Sees it as a strategic asset. Now, I think fast forward to today, the good thing is it's sort of democratized, right? Everyone, there's a lot more companies are being partly forced to do it because of compliance. Mm-hmm. So when there's compliance, well, people have to do it because there's compliance, right? Then, as with everything compliance, people are not happy. Then that gets going. But if we think that, indeed, yes, it's sort of seen as moving back as a compliance thing,
mm-hmm.
But that it's compliance to many, many companies, to the entire industry, right? So if you think about the collective impact, yes, not the best thing to say that it's compliance mainly in people's mm-hmm. mind, but it's compliance in many, many more people's mind.
Yeah,
I hope that this compliance will eventually evolve and people understand it a bit more into, again, a strategic mm-hmm. A strategic function for a lot of companies. And I think if you track some of the very successful company in sustainability, right, you would see that sustainability department moved. Hopefully everyone at some point in time, or every company eventually reached this point where they see that it has to be part of the DNA, it has mm-hmm. to be a strategic consideration,
mm-hmm.
and it sits higher up within the entire organization.
Yeah. I think, and what I hear you saying, and I agree, is that there's a little bit of like on the entity specific basis, maybe a little bit, frankly, of a pullback in terms of what used to be a strategic ambition is now yeah. more of this compliance mandate and just focusing on like making sure you're doing yeah. the thing that the compliance is requiring. But then when you think about that across the market, directionally, the market is shifting, right? Even if like an individual company, yeah. a leader might be coming back, the market is shifting. And then, of course, once the market shifts and you have more companies doing it, that exposure actually become, you know, giving them exposure to the strategic advantage. And then yes. so then you get back into the strategic advantage part. And so I'm not quite sure what that looks like, if it's an infinity sign, but there's some kind of cyclical kind of process there in terms of how a compliance requirement can move the market despite it maybe bringing everybody more towards the center, quite
yeah.
frankly.
Yeah, yeah. I do agree with you. I don't think that's not happening. I think that's true. But hopefully, as sustainability professionals, I think there's an inert optimism in every one of us because we probably see one of the most pessimistic things of, you know, mm-hmm. That's happening. But we tell ourselves, oh, we can do something about it.
Yeah.
Hence, we are all still on this journey, right?
Yep. Well, we just know it's common sense, it's business sense, and everybody else is going to wake up to that, you yeah. know, sooner or later. We wish it was sooner, but yes. I think we all have confidence it's going to happen.
That's Dr. Li Huimian, sustainability leader at Singtel, making the case that sustainability data operates fundamentally differently than the rules of financial data. Precision is the wrong standard. Restatement is a feature. And the supply chain visibility you're counting on stops somewhere around tier two.
So now the question is, what does a controller do with all of that? Because the ESG function is landing on finance teams right now, whether they asked for it or not.
Up next, Jonathan Gregory, global controller at the Hershey Company. Steve, you met with Jonathan in New York and talked about what it looks like to absorb that responsibility inside a complex, multi-acquisition Fortune 500 CPG company, while also staying ahead of AI governance, regulatory change, and everything else that's on the controller's plate in 2026.
Alyssa, it was a wide-ranging talk, but what really stood out to me when talking to Jonathan is that the productivity shift in controllership is already underway and has been for a long time, but governance has to keep pace. Jonathan cautions that AI needs the same segregation of duties, for example, and access controls that you'd apply to any physical asset. Second, regulatory change is the new constant for controllers, from the disaggregated income statement expense accounting standard update to tariff complexity to ESG reporting requirements and regulations. The pace of compliance change isn't slowing down. Stay ahead of the landscape and shifting the workforce to higher value work as automation creates that space.
And here's Steve's chat with Jonathan.
We are here with Jonathan Gregory, corporate controller of the Hershey Company. Is that right?
Global controller.
Global controller.
Yes.
I love it. Now that's a relatively new role. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So transitioned from being just the corporate controller to global controller about a year ago. So I got a couple different things under my umbrella of responsibility. Still reporting to our chief accounting officer, but mainly focused on all things external reporting, technical accounting. I have corporate accounting. So in theory, like our consolidations team, based out of Hershey, which takes everything globally and consolidates it into our final consolidated packet. I have an ESG controller who also oversees legal entity accounting. So we got a whole wide range of responsibilities underneath our little team.
Yeah, well,
Small but mighty.
A lot of control. So the remit has gotten bigger.
It has.
But you've been at the Hershey Company for like 10 years now, right?
Yeah, slightly over 10 years.
Okay, I mean, that's a good run.
It's a good run. It's not over.
I'm not suggesting it is. I'm just saying a decade. I'm just curious. Over that period of time, I'm sure you have seen a lot of changes. I would love to hear just like big picture about that, but maybe what hasn't changed? What's still the same?
Yeah, I think when I first came into Hershey back in 2016, I came in as a manager of external reporting. So I've kind of always been in the chief accounting officer space. You know, we're more of the compliance, filing with the SEC, working with our external auditors. Is that core has not necessarily changed. What really has changed is, number one, the people, our leadership, the vision of the company. In the last 10 years, we've actually acquired several companies, which created a totally different new business unit. So we've done Skinny Pop, Pirate's Booty, Dots Pretzels, and most recently, Lesser Evil back in 2025. So we've really grown this salty business from a non-existent business in 2016 to a very large player in the U.S. So we're very proud of that. That comes with a lot of complexities. It comes with a lot of new challenges and things to work in terms of cross-functionally with new and different teams and different supply chain. Pretzels and popcorn are not made the same as chocolate, in case that's a newsflash to anyone. But, it's exciting. I mean, we work on great brands and products that consumers love. So that definitely has not changed.
Yeah. So I guess I'm wondering, like, if you were having a conversation with Jonathan 10 years ago, and you were this, ghost of Christmas future, I suppose, what would you tell yourself? What insights? I mean, what does somebody need to know 10 years ahead of schedule? And I realize that's like an impossibly long period of time in the current environment. But I mean, any themes come to mind?
You got to keep up with the pace of change. Mm-hmm. In the last 10 years at Hershey, we've had COVID, we've had growth, we've had these acquisitions. There's a lot of pressure in the world of tariffs and supply chain. So how do you respond to those things? And we've also had just normal compliance changes in the world of FASB, SEC. So it's just trying to stay ahead. You always have to stay ahead.
And I would assume that is not a passive activity. That is a very deliberate focus for you and your team, so you don't get tripped up by like the next thing that changes.
Yeah. I mean, we can't predict everything, but we can certainly do what we have to do to, stay current with other peers, other consumer packaged good companies, and, just make sure that we're doing all the right things that we need to be doing and driving things forward.
So one other massive change, of course, is AI. We can't have a conversation without bringing it up, but I'm just wondering, how do you think about that relative to the productivity that you can get, but of course, needing to be sure that it's trusted, verifiable? That's a real balance right now. There are so many, I think, balls in the air that people are trying to juggle.
Yeah. I mean, for us at Hershey, everyone actually has an enterprise-wide digital mindset goal of leveraging AI, using it to be more productive. But when you actually take that down to the individual employee or person, you know, we have a wide range of individuals who maybe aren't so comfortable with AI, others that are trailblazers and creating agents. So it's really interesting to see just the level of education that's needed to get comfortable and actually see those productivity gains. I would say finance specifically, internal audit on our team, on our broader accounting and finance team, they have some real trailblazers in there that are creating agents, doing a lot of work that was manually done, and now they have more time to actually review and verify as opposed to being just doers. So we always tap into some of that knowledge of, hey, how are you using it? How can we use it in controllership, external reporting, or even just more broadly within the finance organization? So in the world of controllership, you know, some of the things are more technical in nature, you know, always bouncing off my gut versus what the ASC and the FASB are actually saying. If we have a complex accounting thing that we just kind of run it through Copilot, and that's what we use. We have everything connected through Microsoft 360, our email, Copilot. So that's kind of our source. And we're just scratching like the tip of the iceberg here at Hershey. We don't have our ERP system where we've invoked. That's a new term that I actually just learned. So I'm very proud of myself. We're just taking things, but also doing all the right things on a governance standpoint. So you just want to make sure that you have right segregation of duties, controls and access, all of the same things as if it was a physical asset, right? Mm-hmm. Like AI, you just don't want it to run rampant. So, you know, you need to be thoughtful. You need to be careful. You need to have the right guardrails in place. But at the end of the day, though, it's just trying to take it piece by piece. Find a quick pain point and try to, you know, see if you could explore with AI. I mean, I've done things where, again, it's just getting a gut check on an accounting transaction or maybe helping me just write some high-level talking points if I have meetings with execs. It helps me personally practice when I'm going to meetings or going to an audit committee meeting. You know, we have pre-submitted materials. So it's like, hey, you know, here are the materials. Help me create a high-level talk track.
Sure.
And then, oh, by the way, maybe ask me some questions that might come from a group of individuals once we're going through this. So it's just helpful practice. And those are just super quick, high level ways that it could be done. And again, we're promoting all of our employees to leverage AI.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, what are going to be the challenges that you're going to need to overcome over the next 5 years? Let's just call it. If you were to sort of fast forward, what do you need to be preparing for now?
Yeah, well, I think there's always going to be regulatory change. You know, we sit here in 2026 and we have disaggregated income statement expense, ASU. That's a challenge. That's kind of like the big bad brother to the previous segment, ASU, that came came out a few years ago. So it's staying ahead on some of the compliance things. It's trying to find new ways to be productive and actually spend time, shift your time, shift the workforce time to things that are more value added. It's just, it's staying ahead of the landscape.
Yeah, well, change is the new constant,
that's
to be sure.
Absolutely right. Yep. Never get comfortable.
Thank you again to our guests, Dr. Lee and Jonathan Gregory. And thank you for listening.
This has been the pre-read brought to you by Workiva, the world's only unified platform for financial reporting, sustainability, audit, and risk.
We've got more insights and hot takes coming your way, so be sure to follow or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your edge.
And if you liked the show, leave a review, send it to someone you love, or just shout it out on your next team call.
We'll see you next time, and until then, go lead it like you mean it.
I'm Steve Soder, and that's Alyssa Zucker. Our lead producer is Mike Gravano, with production support from Shui Tan and audio engineering by Drew Hayes and Faith Springer.
Pedro Sousa is our graphic designer. Transcripts are created and edited by Courtney Kimsey. Thanks to our digital and social team, Mike Berg, Katie Carr, and Michael Karnowski.